the outer forms of these arts and sciences to remain unregenerated. Thus, in the field of learning, alchemy is the regeneration of arts and sciences, not by reforming them, essentially, but by releasing through them the seed of truth which is locked in each one of them. To make the seed grow, to accomplish the mysterious multiplication from the mango seed, like the fabled legend of Indian magic, was the problem of alchemy. Now, in the transmutation of metals, another important point was brought out, and that is that the outer bodies of the metals are irreconcilable. Therefore, that you cannot force iron and lead together and cause them to accomplish an alchemical mystery. You can fuse them to produce an alloy of some kind, but you cannot force them together to release their own spiritual power. Therefore, before metals or elements can be given a new birth in the spirit, they must die. And the death of elements, the destruction of minerals, the complete elimination of the formal nature of the forms of things is part of the alchemical procedure. Therefore, alchemy was a death and a resurrection, and comes very, very close to philosophical symbolism as we come to this level. All of the outer bodies and structures of metals must die before the spirits of these metals can unite to form the mysterious transmuting agent, which is called the Red Lion. This, again, has very great significance, and the alchemist finds comfort in the words of the scripture, "But unless a man be born again, he shall not enter the kingdom of heaven." For every one of the forms of nature must die before the life within that form can be liberated or released. Therefore, alchemy then approaches the problem of human intelligence, and it says that before the individual can become wise, he must destroy the false mind which presumes to possess knowledge. He must destroy opinions before facts can come. He must tear down old walls before he can build a new house. And in the doctrines of the alchemical mysteries, it was first necessary to destroy the personality or the individuality of metals before they could be brought together to form the transmuting agent. Now, in the transmuting agent itself, called the Red Lion, or the powder of rejection, which was one of the great symbols of alchemy, the master was said to carry, particularly Elias Adepta, who was the Elias the artist, that the master carried with him a little box which contained the powder of projection, and that one grain of this powder would transmute into pure gold, 100,000 times its own weight in base metals. Here we are obviously in the presence of an advanced type of symbolism, because obviously the powder of projection represents consciousness itself, all on the level of knowledge, truth, which transforms ignorance, and consciousness itself, which can transform body up to 100,000 times its own weight. Therefore, the power of projection is consciousness itself, by means of which all base substances can be transformed or changed. The Red Lion is the symbol in alchemy of illumination, the mysterious enlightenment from within, which is the rebirth of the soul of the metals. This illumination, according to alchemy, was achieved through the blending of seven arts and sciences, which were the seven sacred arts and sciences of the ancients. Thus we proceed in symbolism a little way. We don't want to go too far now, because we have to examine these things in greater detail. So we then consider the creation of the universal medicine, which was the work of the Illuminists. Now, how is this universal medicine to be found? The basis of this medicine goes back into a very ancient symbolism, and that is the production of the spirits of metals and the spirits of spirit of gold, which can be captured in wine. Theophrastus Paracelsus explained that in certain parts of Switzerland, where there was gold in the soil. Grapevines, sending their tendrils and roots into the earth, gathered up this gold of all forms of vegetation. The grape is the one which has the greatest affinity to gold. And that is in areas where gold is in the soil. The dead vines of grapes are burned, and the ashes of these from this burning are washed. Gold will be found in them. Now, if you study this symbolism a little further, you will begin to recognize the peculiar use of the grape, of the wine, of the Eucharist, and of the mysterious symbols of the early Christian church. The gold, which is gathered for the grape, is the symbol of mystical ecstasy, or the mystical experience in man. For this experience gathers the available consciousness. And we remember that the Christos, or the symbol of the illuminator and the initiator, refers to himself by saying, "I am the vine." This mysterious vine of life, the grape, the symbol of the Dionysian Eucharist, and later brought into the church, is therefore closely associated, as with the Grail, with illumination. The universal medicine is the mystical experience arising within the individual. It is the basis of the healing of himself and of all nations, and it is in the bringing about of the power of the healing of all sickness, for sickness is healed by the mystery of grace. And in alchemy, the grape and the grace are identical in meaning. So we have here a heavy mystical overtone, overshadowing the physical or alchemical symbolism as we generally accept it. You'll find work on this subject and the development of it in the work by General Ethan Colin Hitchcock, American Civil War General, in his Mysteries of Alchemy. Now, the lapis philosophorum, or the diamond soul, also is reminiscent of many religious systems. In Tibetan Buddhism, the diamond soul appears as one of the most important symbols of the world deity. In alchemy, the ruby diamond is the most important of all the symbols. It is a synthetic stone, so made that it has a drop of blood in the center. I have seen in Europe two or three ruby diamonds made by art and nature, by alchemical transmutation. We recently have read in the paper that at last a completely synthetic diamond, absolutely perfect, has been discovered. And this undoubtedly is the same basic principle as the idea of alchemy. For this reason, alchemy says very simply, that which occurs psychologically within man will also occur physically in chemistry. In other words, alchemy does not deny that base metals can be transmuted. But it says that the laws used in this are the same laws as those used in the transmutation of man himself. Therefore, if the individual gains the secret art for the transmutation of his own nature, he can also transmute physical substances. Because one set of laws is involved. If, however, he attempts to transmute base metals without having the secret of the transmutation within his own consciousness, he will not only fail to transmute his consciousness, but will be unable to transmute the metals. Many alchemists began their work as experimental chemists. And this brings us another important key to the thing. These experimental chemists began by a sincere and inevitable conviction that they could transmute base metals physically. So they took the writings of the alchemists with their strange descriptions of mysterious monsters, of agents, of black birds, of double-headed phoenixes, of kings and queens, of the celestial hermaphrodite, of the crystal homunculus, and all these other emblems of alchemy. And they began to ponder them, trying to find out how to make them understand. That's how they found out. They pawned their family goods. They went out and bought all kinds of equipment, from alembics, retorts, test tubes, and furnaces, and with bellows and artistry, they blew and they puffed. like Titus de Mirandola, who spent many years working on the traffic but did not arrive, or Eugenius Philippides, who finally was killed by an experiment in his own laboratory. But these artists, struggling to understand the symbols, fighting day by day with the processes in their recourse, gathering their dew on the plates of glass on the various configurations of the constellations, seeking for the gold-bearing grapevine, working with the formulas, studying the designs and symbols. These very physical chemists, as Michael Sendivogius tells us, who was one of them, started with this simple intent to transmute base metals to become rich. But they hadn't gone very far when something began to happen to them. They began to find within themselves a realization that they were too limited in their own perspective. As they went along in their researches, they found they depended upon faculties keener than those of mere reading. One of the simplest things they had to face was the problem of trying to find out what the author had concealed behind these strange devices. These devices became meditation wheels. They became like Buddhist mandalas. They began to challenge the individual who studied them. And as months went on and years went on, and this individual went further and further into the arts, he began to sense within himself other dimensions that he had not previously considered. And after he had been working more than 10 years in his laboratory, Sendivogius suddenly came to the realization that alchemy was not a physical science, but a spiritual one. He discovered himself. It grew on him, so to say. He learned step by step through the unfoldment of his own faculties. He found then that this mysterious twisting road that led through the symbols was a constant coaxing of something out of himself. He finally grew to be so intuitive that he could read between the lines. And as he began to read between the lines, he began to see the larger dimensions of the art. Until at last, he cried out in dismay and distress to think that he had wasted so much time on the outer shadow of something that was so much more important than he had originally believed. Gradually, he found that the study of these symbols released something out of his own nature. And he began to sense the real mysteries of alchemy. So we have another definition that has to sink in somewhere along the line, and might as well slip in right now. Namely, that the initiate is the intellect. That the illuminate is the intuition. And that the adeptus is the conscience. And that they're all inside of himself and all his world. But the alchemical adept is the mysterious power of consciousness operating through will and yoga. And that every human being is his own adept. And that Elias Batista, the master of the adept, who appears and disappears without leaving trace, coming when he is most needed, disappearing no one knows where, represents these flashes of consciousness by which the individual suddenly and briefly senses his own internal. That there is something within himself that does not respond to his demands, but somehow responds to his needs. Elias the artist is his own consciousness. The great fire of alchemy is his own will, by means of which these mysteries are wrought. The illuminant is his own psychic nature, particularly his intuitional and inspirational part. And the initiate is his mind. Which can always know the secret, but can never experience it. So the adept himself, in all his parts, is the alchemist, growing step by step through the experiences of his own art. As we recognize these principles gradually becoming more and more clearly to us, we also can go on further. In the alchemical transmutation, we have a bottle. It's a very interesting bottle. It's a kind of a bulgy bottle with a long, sometimes a rather long neck. And within this bottle are a number of strange devices. One of the more common and frequent of which is a peacock with an extended tail in many iridescent colors. And the initiate seeking the stone is told to watch for the appearance of the peacock's tail in the bottle. In the emblems of Salomon Trismegistus, called the Splendor Solis, we have a good many examples of this wonderful adventure taking place in a glass bottle. This was called the hermetic womb in the rites and in the ancient mysteries. And this undoubtedly has one very simple meaning. This glass bottle is the human soul. And it is within this soul that the mystery of the seven transmutations takes place. Now, you remember in the last series when we were talking about yoga, I pointed out the importance of recognizing that the human soul corresponds with the orbits of the seven planets, and that the soul of man represents the seal of the seven cardinal virtues, the seven deadly sins, which reflect downward into the physical phenomena of the seven liberal arts and sciences. Therefore, the second part of the work of the Illuminate, takes place within the soul, and the bottle, it must contain the universal medicine. Now, this universal medicine is achieved through the mystery of the seven parts of the human soul, a doctrine which originated probably in Egypt, where there is specific reference to the seven souls of man, and how they in turn influence the destiny of his life. Now, when we get up into the higher level of the adeptus, we also begin to see this cut diamond with its various facets and symbols. And the further we go into that diamond and the study of it, the closer we get to the great geometric solids of Plato and Pythagoras. The diamond is a symbol of a symmetrical geometric solid, the sign of the perfect form in nature. The diamond soul is itself, of course, a symbol of the universe. It is a symbol of consciousness. It is a symbol of spirit. It is a symbol of the perfect power which is released or made possible or available to man through regeneration. Now, all these different elements become more than mere hints. We must accept them as hints. We must work with them as best we can until we gain more and more knowledge of them. Now, also in alchemy, you have another mysterious symbolism which is called the ladder of the sages, or Homer's golden chain, which binds the ship of life to the pinnacle of Olympus. Homer's golden chain is a sequence of seven interlocking elemental symbols, by means of which spirit and body are united. The soul is therefore the symbol of union, and that comes out of this another great and important emblem, and that is the rise of the term hermetic. Hermetic is associated with the later Egyptian divinity Hermes, who belongs to the period of the Gnostic revivals in North Africa, is a very mysterious being around whom the great vision of the Priamandries of Hermes has been compiled. So we use the word hermetic today to symbolize something that is sealed so that air cannot get in, the hermetically sealed jars or bottles. This is again a reference to alchemy. Hermes was the patron of alchemy, which was also referred to as the Hermetic Art. Now, Hermes carries always the caduceus, or the winged staff. He's represented with wings on his heels and wings on his hat, and usually dressed somewhat in the garb of a Roman soldier. He's a kind of an effective-looking little fellow in his own way, but very few students have really given him a great deal of thought. Now, Mercury, in the old astrological symbolism, has to do with the intellect, and to a certain degree it still has that relation in alchemy, because mind unites spirit and body. Mind is the link between man as an internal and man as an external being. So the mind man becomes into himself from environment, and through the mind man expresses the inner nature of his own consciousness. Thus mind is a common ground within himself. But the alchemists used mind much more in the sense that we use the psyche or the soul. For to them it included both male and female attributes. and represented a psychic field or pattern. And Mercury was therefore the common solvent or quicksilver by which all metals could be united or brought into synthesis. Mercury was the absorbing power. So that actually, according to their doctrine, the Philosopher's Stone was composed of the union of salt, mercury, and sulfur. Sulfur representing consciousness or spirit, salt representing earth or body, and mercury representing mind or the solvent. In this symbolism, using the Hermetic analogy, we come upon a number of very interesting and important parallels or elements, each of which we will gradually develop along with other symbols. Mercury now emerges as something that unites or forms a common ground, absorbing into itself things otherwise irreconcilable. Let us try to understand that in terms of human experience, in something that is familiar to us. What is there about us as beings, or what faculty or power do we possess by which we can reconcile opposites? By which we can bind together through experience things held differently or regarded as irreconcilable in nature or quality. What is this most mysterious and absorbing agent? The Greeks and later the Hermetists and the Alchemists declared that the psychic field of man was capable of accepting from above spiritual power and reducing them to the level of mind and emotion, and that this also, the soul, was able to cause bodily elements and external phenomena to ascend into this middle zone and be absorbed into soul quality, so that the soul was the common denominator, the link, the common field into which both spirit and matter passed, and in which they seem to die, to be reborn again as one body or being. So we can say that in the Hermetic allegory, consciousness, which is the spiritual power, descending into the field of Mercury or into the soul, manifests itself as intellect and intuition. Whereas bodily elements or energies ascending into the soul also took on an attribute or aspect of intellect and intuition, so that they took on an overtone and were reconciled in this field, and that therefore man, through a kind of experience within himself, achieved an alchemy in which he transmuted the opposites of his own nature and cause them to become one being within the sphere of soul power. So we have the formula very simple. We have the king and queen, which are spirit and body, or God and nature, producing the homunculus, or the crystal creature, which is man. Man, therefore, is Hermes. Man is the unifier. Man is the personification of the principle of the Hermetic medicine. In man, heaven and earth are mingled. In man, the divine and the human are brought together in one structure. In man, all opposites of nature meet. And in man, in his own nature, and in his own existence, in his own attitude, the creation of the diamond soul is made possible. Thus Hermes or Mercury is man. Man, composed of certain powers and faculties, particularly the seven powers of the soul. These seven powers of the soul being the basis of the harmony or synthesis by which the divine and the human, or the divine and the mortal, are brought together. Thus man becomes the potential alchemist. So we have in the old symbolism heaven, earth, and the alchemist. Now we find many such symbols. Heaven represented as a divine being. Earth represented as a wonderful fecundity of life, the king and queen again, holding between them man, who is the potential agate, who is the potential redeemer of all things and the transmuter of the universe in which he is placed. Now this heaven earth man being begins to bring another point into consideration, which we have in alchemy. So we have a trinity of terms which are found in certain of the old alchemical ABC books, as they are called, the Abecedarian writings of early alchemy. And here we have God, nature, and art. Now alchemy was called art. And it was called art in a definition which says, an art perfects nature. Alchemy says there are no miracles to be performed by art. Art merely anticipates nature and achieves its greatest work by becoming a handmaiden of nature. Bacon, the English philosopher, refers to art as the power to perfect nature through intelligent cooperation. So art becomes the symbol of alchemy. In nature, all things are growing. All things are unfolding their life. And all things are moving inevitably and victoriously towards perfection, or towards the state of pure and complete being. But the path is slow, the means are continuous, and the achievements are imperceptible at any given time. Now in a field of man's researches, such as horticulture, for example, comes along a person like Luther Burbank, or a man like Dr. Carver. He begins to fulfill the alchemical adage that art perfects nature. Burbank became a great student of plant life. And he finally learned how to use the laws governing plant life to hasten the growth of plants. He didn't break any laws. He didn't perform any miracles. He simply used knowledge and helped a plant to help itself. This is art, which is man's voluntary cooperation with the plan of life. The plan will be perfected without man, but it will take millions of years. Man will perfect himself over a great period of experience by trial and error. Man will go on suffering, dying, until he learns how to live. This is the long road. He will continue to make mistakes, will learn ultimately the laws governing his own conduct, and in the fullness of time will learn to keep those laws. But man may also do many things. He may learn how to work with laws. He may learn that through his own voluntary cooperation, he can make things grow more rapidly. Through will, wisdom, and discipline, he can make himself grow more rapidly. Not by performing a miracle, but by cooperating with nature. So we find alchemy defined as the servant of nature. Not a magician waving a wand, but a gardener working with a spade in the garden. And in the opening sections of Michael Myers, one of his books, we have alchemy as the gardener working with a spade, very carefully cultivating around the rose bush. There's no description given, but there's none necessary. This is art the gardener, making possible the more immediate and perfect growth of the flower. The rose, of course, is all the hero's love and our prospect for the human soul. So soul gardening is an art. And the alchemist is the gardener in this great and mysterious garden of the metals. So we find around the gardener growing on various trees symbols of all the metals. He is a gardener working in the field of the metals. He is making them to grow. The artist also is the gardener working in the garden of his own soul, making it to grow, releasing the seven powers and faculties which are exoterically represented by the seven senses of man, unfolding all the potentials there, keeping faith with the law, making the law to reveal itself through working with it, through following its own rules and causing the law to fulfill itself more immediately through obedience. Another symbolism appropriate to the idea is the gardener weeding his garden. He has valuable plants there which he wishes to protect. Therefore, he takes away the weeds. He fertilizes the ground. He cultivates it and makes it possible for his precious plants to grow better. Now, also, we find the garden sometimes symbolized as a little fenced-in enclosure. in which, as like as not, you will find two animals, a lion and a unicorn. And we all remember the good old nursery rhyme, the lion and the unicorn fighting for the crown. And you'll find that the lion and the unicorn bring suits on the supporters to crest of Great Britain, the British Empire. The unicorn is a very wonderful creature, with one horn in its forehead, made like a horse. The unicorn is a very, very sensitive, delicate animal, and always likes to be around kindly people. The unicorn will very patiently and lovingly follow the mysterious virgin of the world, Sophia, who is the only one that can put a bridle on it. This is a very interesting bit of symbolism also, because what is one horn but one pointed? And what is one pointed except will or consciousness itself? Therefore, the unicorn represents the power of will, the conscious will of the individual. The lion, of course, the red lion, we know to be the symbol of the mystery or of the great powder of transmutation or corruption. We know that the lion, in this case, represents wisdom. The will and wisdom captured in a god can accomplish great and wonderful things. Because the struggle of will and wisdom, seeking for the crown, of course, the crown is Kemar, the symbol in the Hebrew Kabbalah of the supreme power, of the supreme reality of all things, the crown of power and rulership. There are many, many uses of alchemical symbolism in other departments of living. We also find, for example, in the alchemical doctrine, constant references to various symbols used in the Bible. We find, for instance, that the complete transmutation and the production of the mysterious universal medicine is believed to be contained within the Canticles of Solomon. In other words, the song which is Solomon's contains the complete formula for the production of universal medicine. And the alchemist can break it down and show you word for word, line for line, how that follows through the various researches and various cycles of transmutation. Another very important alchemical formula is said to be concealed in the Lord's Prayer. Now, the alchemist who recognized that that is true were telling two stories at one time. They were telling that they had found that the Lord's Prayer was an exact example of psychic chemistry. But they were also telling you that the end of psychic chemistry was the achievement of the spiritual state represented in the Lord's Prayer. It worked both ways. And that also, that the state of holiness, or piety, or the state of prayerful contemplation of reality, was the alchemical transmutation. That the transmutation of fear into faith, for example, was the overcoming of the black symbol of Israel. All of these things worked out on moral and ethical levels. The only difference between them and our general concept of knowledge lies in the exactitude of the symbol. For example, the alchemist says that the sun in the air, in the sky, that is represented in the earth by gold. Therefore, the gold and the sun are the same thing exactly in vibratory principle. And that the gold in the earth and the sun in the sky are polarized to the pulse point in the human heart. And therefore, that the human heart, the sun and gold, are all in sympathetic ratio to each other. And that they are of an identical and proper nature. And that they have certain powers in common. Dr. Rudolf Steiner and his researches in Switzerland in connection with the use of the talismanic metals of the ancients in healing disease discovered what we have also learned later by other means, namely that potable gold, or what we might term biological gold, is a heart remedy. And that a simple gold goes directly into the walls of the heart. Thus, the sympathy that was represented in alchemy was recognized as an existing fact in nature, and that these different principles all work together. Now, the same thing was true with other parts of the universe. Everything that was morally true was scientifically true. If it is true, for example, that wisdom is better than ignorance, that can be proved on terms of chemistry. It can be proved in terms of music, in color, in tone, in sound, in everything. That all values that exist ethically also exist scientifically. And that the polarities of all the elements are to be found in the moral and spiritual life of the individual. And that which constitutes a good life also constitutes an exact working formula for a chemical compound. That just as surely as man is able to integrate certain patterns in his own living, the laws governing these patterns are exactly the same as those used in architecture. And a happy, harmonious, well-integrated home can be mathematically diagrammed, and the diagram will be the perfect structure for a building. This is what Leonardo meant by certain of his canons. In other words, there is a dynamic which extends from one level of life to another. Pythagoras knew that if you played a certain chord of music, that this chord, in its mathematical vibration, could be and was equivalent to the basic key to the structure of a building, the basic key to a chemical compound, a basic formula in law, everything. All these things work together constantly. Therefore, if you have a perfect method of purifying a metal, you have a perfect method of purifying the government, a perfect method of purifying the human body, and the human soul, and the human mind. If you can make certain elements work together, you can make certain philosophies work together, certain sciences meet, certain races mingle. All these things are ruled by the same law. There is one master pattern, which is the great archetype. And all our sciences unfold this archetype. And whatever is true of the individual is true of the collective. Whatever the law is working in nature, it must work in man. And just as surely as certain energies in space unite to produce worlds, so certain energies in man must meet and mingle to produce the development and unfoldment of his body and his functions. There is only one set of laws. And these laws become the keys to the Hermetic art. For the Hermetic art is nothing but the reduction of good intentions to a science. These arts tell you that if you have seven powers of metals in nature, you have seven organs in the body, you have seven glandular structures of importance within the body, you have seven principal orifices in the body, you have seven principal centers in the brain. All of these are tied together by a sympathy. And as you have certain planets in the sky, so you have certain planets in the soul. And as these planets, by their forms, release certain psychic energies and intensities through man, these seven energies have in their turn created the arts and sciences, which are nothing but rationalizations by man on all lines of his own energy. Man is able to build a house and to master architecture because he has a principle of architecture in his own soul. That principle of architecture within his own soul is represented by one of the seven metals. If, therefore, he lacked a certain element within his constitution, he would lack a dimension of consciousness. If gold was removed from his body, he would not only die, but assuming that he did not die, a proportion or dimension of consciousness would depart from him. Every one of these things is tied together, forming one tremendous, all-inclusive pattern. And the pattern itself was described in the Hermetic arts as the tomb of Christian Rosenkreuz. For in this tomb was all of the symbolism of a miniature universe, and in the ceiling of it burned the ever-burning lamp, which was the symbol of consciousness. As therefore the consciousness in nature produces the world, so the consciousness in man sets up septenaries within itself. These septenaries are all on sympathy with each other, exactly like tuning forks, which at the same pitch will react to the sound one on the other. The same way diseases represent certain perversities in vibratory rates. These diseases can be reached by sounding their keynotes,
they can be neutralized by other rates of vibration, representing their antipathies. This was the basis of the sympathetic medicine of Paracelsus, who treated the ailments of Mars with the power of Venus and the ailments of Saturn with the power of Jupiter. But when you say Saturn and Jupiter as planets, you're also referring to elements, to minerals, to medications, to degrees of consciousness, to sense perceptions, to soul perceptions, to intuitional faculties, and to the whole gamut. Because all of these things move on the same vibration patterns. Thus we have in alchemy this concept of one universe, in which a series of formulas exist. Now the alchemist took the universal formula, or space, which is the largest, and he reduced it to a formula that he could follow in his laboratory, and we can borrow a little bit from von Welling, in order that we may understand the symbolism a little better. In his great work on salt, sulfur, and mercury, von Welling says that he took a tiny grain of the universal medicine and placed it on the surface of water in a foreign pot, which he gametrically sealed. He then placed this retort on a sand furnace. And a sand furnace is one in which the temperature is maintained at about the heat of the human body, which is very important. It never got too warm. The heat was applied only through sand. There was a thick layer of sand between the heat and the retort resting in the sand. And von Welling says that after a certain time, when the heat within the bottle reached that temperature of incubation, or the temperature, as he says, that is achieved by the hen sitting on an egg, when that peculiar natural heat level was reached, this grain of the elixir, or the mysterious powder, began to move. And he said as he watched it, it began to spin. And as it spun, it threw parts of itself off. And these parts that flew off began to move around it. And in a half an hour, he saw unfold within the retort a complete solar system. Why? Because every unit must follow the law of the entire. Now, if he had used a different level of analogy, he could have taken that same grain, placed it within another type of bottle, with another group of elements to work with, and under the same heat and length of time, this grain of the eternal elixir would have begun to move in a different direction, would gradually have taken the whirling proportions of the human embryo, and would have ultimately developed into a human body called the homunculus. Would have done exactly the same thing. And he would have had the tiny human being in the body. Now we also have, in the Paracelsian theory, the possibility of reviving all kinds of forms from their own ashes. This we have under various symbolism. A plant burned to ashes within a sealed bottle, and then under a certain type of pressure and under a certain use of alchemical formulas, heat it to a certain degree. The plant, or a shadow of it, will grow again in the bottle, in ashes. Years ago, I had an interesting experience with which we will try to explain this. A man came to me who had spent many years up in the northern part of Canada, along the Klondike. He was an old gold miner. And he said, there is something that I've never been able to understand. Namely, that gold grows. He said, we could work out a vein, leave it for 10 years, and come back to it, and there was more gold there. He said, we were convinced that this gold accumulated in some way, drawn by whatever amount of gold that was still left in the vein, the little part that we didn't get. The seeds were still there, and this gold grew. And he said, as a proof of that, he said, I took a piece of ore with a small amount of gold still in it, and I placed that gold in an electrically sealed jar, small jar. This was just a little bottle about this size, about 2 inches in diameter. He said, I have not unsealed this, and I want to show it to you. He said, when I placed it in there,
Many years ago, there was just a grain of gold in it. But now, many years later, that little grain of gold has become a perfect little tree. It has grown from its own seed, the growth of metals. And he said, I will tell you something else and show it to me. And it was undoubtedly exactly as he had described, and I'm inclined to believe him because we have the same record exactly from the Swiss gold miners of the 16th and 17th centuries who said that they had actually made gold grow. But another interesting thing this old miner told me was, he said, it didn't grow nearly as rapidly until I happened to discover something. Namely, that it grew more if I kept it on me. So therefore, I used to have many months I carried it inside my clothing, this little box. Because whenever it was close to me, it grew. And of course, the answer was body heat. As long as it was close to his body, it grew. And reports of these experiments have been carried on for hundreds of years. And the concept of gold growing in the rocks, gold growing in the human body, body growing, all of these things tie up with the alchemical tradition, which is that all things grow. And that as the metals grow under certain conditions, so man grows. And what is the gentle heat which matures the metals? And the Buddhist might answer, the fire of aspiration by which all things grow. But there is a second mood or spirit within man, a want of man's own soul that makes him grow. And in the presence of this want within himself, and this warmth is the warmth of the mother hen sitting on the egg, which even in itself is a rather interesting thing, because it is the warmth of love. It is the warmth of service, of protection. All these things work together. And in alchemy, the universe is one mass of these interrelated laws. Laws which can be diagrammed on one level, played on a musical instrument on another, and on a third level, if applied inwardly, transform the sinner into the saint. They are living laws, living patterns, living archetypes, forever reproducing themselves on all levels. The alchemist says, if you can discover these on one level, you can then apply this key to all other levels, and have them, indeed, the key to the mystery of the universe. So this is a little something of the background. And from that, we must go on with the psychology of this, and the science of it, and I'll try to show you as we go along the symbols, the artistry, the books, the manuscripts by which this symbolism, this concept is unfolded. And it is the great hermetic allegory, or the great law of analogy, as above, so below, as with the lesser, so with the greater. All things differing in multitude and magnitude, but all identical in the great pattern of vital principles that sustain them. To know these principles, then, is to be the magician, to be the master of all things by knowing the laws and obeying the laws. And art is man's learning to obey, his constructive and wonderful ability to take these principles and amplify them so that they work more rapidly and perfect themselves more perfectly. Man working with law, therefore, is the master alchemist. If he works with the law works for him, and he sees things grow and multiply in days, months, or years, which might otherwise require ages, unless they receive the cultivation of the hermetic gardener. This is the concept on which we must later build the more detailed account of the alchemical procedures. Now our time is up for tonight, and I'd like to make one...